on Paula and
Joel.
Joel, he'd remembered it today. Andrew Britson, we've been overseas with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America in the more recent years in Papua New Guinea. Before that, we were with Missouri Synod over there and then moved into ALC as our assignment changed over there, and then now into EFCA. I'll just recap a few things for people who maybe don't know too much about the country and see it, if I can answer your kind services.
Oh, my services.
I thought you were going to do it.
Yeah.
Or not. And we'll just show you where Papua New Guinea is first on the main map. It's over there, just above Australia. So if you left Washington State, you would go across the Pacific and come up to Papua New Guinea. Papua New Guinea being the independent nation on the right-hand side of that island above Australia. The left-hand side belongs to Indonesia. Originally, it was Dutch New Guinea, and after the, quote, plebiscite in 68, it came under the government of Indonesia. The country Papua New Guinea now you'll see is on the right-hand side. We can maybe then just learn some facts about Papua New Guinea, just some brief ones to recap a little bit so you get an idea of who the people are who live there, a little bit about them, and Greek scholar over here. Is that all right?
Ralph can give us a description of Mellos.
Mellos is from the Greek.
It's Black Island.
Black Island. From the Greek, and it includes Papua New Guinea and the other half of the island, which is Irian Jaya, belonging to Indonesia, Fiji, Vanuatu, which used to be the New Hebrides, New Caledonia. How many is that?
One. Did you say Fiji?
Fiji, New Caledonia, Vanuatu,
and
the Solomon Islands. All right, six. Okay.
And are those just above? Where are those?
Yeah, they're off to this direction
to the right.
Over
yeah.
Here.
Where's Fiji?
Fiji is
the farthest right off of the island group.
Yeah, if you go that way. It's not even that. It doesn't even go that far.
The Solomons. Yeah, it's Fiji would be the furthest one over here. Yeah. So the Fiji is the outer limit that way.
And then you begin Polynesia. In that way of dividing things up, Micronesia, Polynesia.
So it's a distinct area in the Pacific. Well, we talked the other day about kind of some cultural things, and I used the Bilom, which is common to most parts of Papua New Guinea. There's some areas that don't make Biloms. You've seen them hanging all the time out there, made from natural fibers, various kinds. Grasses, tree bark, reeds, hemp plants. Each area has its own source. And each area has its own patterning, its own type of weave, its own use for it sometimes. And it's kind of like the culture of the country. It's just so varied. It's hard to put your finger on it sometimes. You can say it's Melanesia, but within it, like you can see, there's 800 languages, so that's 800 different cultures. So it's a culture, yes, but you have to realize that there are various differences with all the people within that country. Quite amazing, just like the Bilums. And Bilum is a pidgin term for net or string bag, B-I-L-U-M. I think that's enough on that, maybe. And we'll move thinking now about our some of the things we talked about. Maybe you can draw the picture since you're over there. We talked the other day of things that are extremely important in the cultures of Papua New Guinea. And the main thing people wanted in their search was the good life, Gutpla Sindown, if you say it in pidgin, Gutpla, which would be good, and Sindown, if you subtract the N and add a T, sit down. And so you're sitting down really well, you're enjoying life. And what is life to a Papua New Guinean? It's quite different than what it would be to us. We have, first of all, it's people, the community that you live with, the people around you. Everyone in that area is extremely important to you, and you are important to them. So people are very much needed in this.
Both living and?
And those who have died, ancestors. And we're not saying ancestor worship here. We are saying that in our culture, we don't deal with those things in our minds that we can't describe. We're a fact culture, and we need it in fact. These people deal in everything around us, and the spirits are always with us. I guess I'd like to describe it as thinking about things I do. I can remember especially when I was younger or teenage years and thinking, what would my mother think now with what I'm doing? You know, and that's, she wasn't physically with me, but she was there. She was definitely there. And after she died, I mean, there's things I still remember and think about, gosh, I wonder what Mom would say about this. You know, I'd like to, you know, and you kind of run it through in your mind. To me, you know, my mother is dead in the body, but somehow, you know, she's still around as my father. And these people also, it's probably much richer than that's fairly simplistically stated for my part. Their cosmos is much larger and much richer, goes back generations and generations and generations. So it's the living and those who've died are part of you. That's part of your life today. What else? We have... Okay. Maybe I'll do it this way, dramatic people. We have some trousers here. Most people wear some sort of amount of clothing. So we've got people in here, and we'll put a layer in here for the spirits that are around us as well. And then we think of some of the natural things that we see, and I guess the trees and everything are very important to us. Put that in there. That's all part of my good life.
That's a coconut tree.
That's a coconut tree, I'm sorry. No, they do have pine trees over there. We'll put this as part of our plant world as well. I didn't pick anything, I just picked it off the ground, so.
What is that?
I didn't pick anything, I picked it off the ground.
What is that?
Just plant, I'm using it for plant life and all the other vegetation growing around us. I couldn't find an animal to bring along. I didn't think you'd appreciate the residues thereof, so.
She asked
it's
me.
It's in there.
A little bird or something.
A little bird, yeah. Chipmunk ant or something.
And perhaps it's important to say what kind of an animal in Melanesia this really is, because that's important. There's really a main animal. What would you think that is?
Pig. The pig.
The pig, yeah, that's it.
It's a very valuable piece. Yeah, very much whelp. Water and essential for whatever. And what else? I guess I'll, I don't know if I should leave this to last or there's more in there.
It's about it.
I'll use the rock because rock breaks down and becomes land and soil. And land to a Papua New Guinean is life. It's not something you buy and sell. It is your life. If you don't have land, what do you have? You have none of the rest of these things that make up the good life.
Does that mean private ownership?
Not private in the sense that we would know it. It is private. There are certain areas that belong to certain tribal groups or clans or lines, depending how you look at it. And they're very knowledgeable about their boundaries. You and I couldn't see them, but they sure know where their boundaries are. And it's a very big issue in the country, especially now with the rising population. Where are these boundaries? And disputes that were hundreds of years ago now can come to the forward when land becomes an issue and say, well, my ancestors, you know, this was where it was before. So people know their boundaries within their land, yeah.
But it's a tribal sense, not yeah, personal.
Not personal. It belongs to everybody within that community.
Do they go for one tribe?
Will depend. If they're trading partners, they will cross between areas. Now people move much more freely because you're mixing now, which before you never ever did. Unless you were marrying across and then solidifying a relationship there, or trading and making a relationship there. Otherwise, you probably didn't go across to many other people. You had certain ones you went to and many that you didn't. Is that about? Yeah. But now it's becoming much more accessible and people are moving more freely. And I think we'll get into this with values and relationships and talk a bit more about that. That's important. So as you can see, I'm pulapya. I've filled my belly with all things in the good life, but I'm having a problem.
You don't have a baby in there.
I don't have a baby in here today. That's right. Yes, I don't have a baby in here today. That's what we, the other day. It's a common, as you'll see, you're welcome to look through that calendar. It's all on Billings. The common thing to find in here are babies. It's an ideal thing to carry them in. Just marvelous. And that's a diversity in culture. You kind of at first say, what? You must be joking. And then you begin to realize why people do it. You know, I can't carry somebody on my head though. My grass is, my hair is too thin and stringy and silky, and the handle would fall right off. But for Papua New Guineans, it's an ideal way to carry babies, especially any other loads that you have. Ideal. It stretches and pulls.
They must have wrestlers' necks.
Strong.
They yes, do. Women right. do have very strong, and they start out at a very young age. These are all natural fiber, and that's a more store-bought fiber. It's probably a polyester of some sort. I don't think it's all wool. But yeah, they're strong. They last a long time, and once they're finished, and then you get rid of them. But this is great, only I'm having a difficult time here. It's kind of, my arms are gonna get tired. What do I need in this thing? Something's missing.
A handle. Yeah.
By golly, you're right. It needs a handle. And for somebody like me from the Western world, I'm going to carry it like this because that makes sense to me. But a Papua New Guinean will put it up here. And if you're a woman, you carry it on your head. Like so. So what we're trying to say today is the good life is all these things, and it fits inside something that's very, can change, and changes with different experiences, with different times, with what's inside it. It's not something that's rigid, the Papua New Guinea culture, but it needs something else. The good life needs something else to support it, and this is a value system. Without a value system, this good life is absolutely nothing. We can't even deal with it. So maybe on that score, Joel, you want to take over.
You're doing a good job. Just keep going. Let me just erase this. And I think what Paula said is important when she used the word cosmos. and that it's a world view. It's the way people see things, and it's what we say is holistic, that everything is fit together into the one whole. You don't separate things out, that you put sacred spiritual things in one side and you put secular and those related things in another, and then once in a while you cross the boundaries and try to bring them together. Rather, I found very much so that things are brought together, they're at one. And I think that's very much a part of what we have in the traditional culture. And now, of course, and when we talk about values, we have to bring in another aspect of culture, and that is modern. And literally, sometimes, for people, especially who are growing up in this particular time, to get a handle on where the values really are is a very challenging kind of thing. So what I would like us to keep in mind as we talk about all of this, that really it's not accurate to talk about traditional culture in Papua New Guinea, modern culture in Papua New Guinea, because really what we're talking about is something that I would like to say in this way. It's a transitional kind of a culture. And I think it's one of the significant tasks of the church and of how it works and relates theology to what is happening in the traditional world and in the modern impact of the people of Papua New Guinea. Now, values to achieve that good life are extremely important. Just maybe for a start, what kind of values from our own Western culture here where you are, could you say leads to a life that has meaning and that has purpose and vision? Can you just toss out some values that are
freedom
important
and choice.
To you? All right. Anything else?
Well, we have to always have, something to eat, and we have, somehow the system has to support our life.
Okay, so some kind of material.
We expect that, that people aren't going to starve, but somehow the system's going to give us enough to eat.
Is that the way maybe we could say it? Some material benefits that support life?
Yeah, life support or something like that. Mm-hmm.
Anybody
recognition
else?
Of the individual.
The
recognition of the individual.
Individual. Okay, I'll just abbreviate that. Good. Anybody else? Just say whatever comes to your mind when you think of that as a value that is important to you in your being a part of this society.
My religious beliefs.
Okay, your beliefs, yeah. Just bringing that in. Anything else? The value. Shaping, informing, giving purpose to life.
You have to have some sort of protection. You have to have some law and order or something like that to protect.
All right.
To keep some sort of
law, order, security, something like that. All right, well, maybe that's enough to begin with. I think that gives us at least a feeling of maybe what we think of when we think of values that we might have. Now, the building blocks for Papua New Guinea, for Melanesians, would be somewhat the same there. I think that one of the things that we would have to state clearly would be, we'll go to this one right here, the recognition of the individual. There's another aspect to that in Melanesia, and that is this word here. Community. That's one of those essential building blocks. It's a value that the community in Melanesia actually stands above the individual. And now that's where some of the tensions begin to come in, because the individuals have left that net of the community, separated themselves out of it, and it's not, in a lot of cases, the community that has been important or getting the attention, but it's the individual. So this is one of the difficulties in the transitional society in Melanesia, because in traditional life, the community was really the essence of everything. Religion, I think we could say that...
You just went down. Did you know what you were going to find when you got there?
No, not really. I had a little guidebook, but it wasn't...
If you go to Palenque, you must go down there, and don't be afraid. You can take... Always you set your own pace, and you can make it where you want to go. This is the glyph panel. It's eroded badly. But at certain times of the day when the shadows are just right on there, because light comes in through those open porticos there.
I don't think I was even aware of that. Isn't that funny?
Yes. Well, it's... You have to know what you're looking for,
yeah.
Really. And that they can now read these glyphs. This complicated system of writing, at which the Maya were experts, allowed them to express the most complicated thoughts that they had. And you look at this and you think, how could they do that with those things? But they could, and they have now established that those stand for phonemes, some of those little configurations, which when you put them together make words, just like astrology, astroenology. So they have found that that's what you do. You put these phonemes together and construct words, and there it is. We're looking now out over that plain, that Tabasco plain that is swampy, and notice how flat it is. It's flat 50 miles into the Campeche Bay. It just goes straight off. And you are just at the base of the rising Pook Mountains, which are behind the Temple of the Inscription. And can you see the encroaching forest there? If they don't keep cutting it back, it just gobble up the whole thing again, just like it did in the 800s.
That's in the middle of a jungle. It's really kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. We're looking down on the palace now, and you can see the east and west galleries there. They are built exactly alike. And you can see that there were once apartment sections in there. And you can see that there's a kind of a walkway along there through that gallery. There is an altar in the second flight of steps there. It's important to keep in mind too that plain that stretches out there. And you can see the north group beyond the roof of the palace. And not too much has been done with it. But the thing that was interesting to me was that when you went in and out of those small structures, there was always a cartouche with glyphs in it, which you are told represents something about the people who once lived in that place. This is a beautiful sight. It's my favorite of all, simply because it's so pleasing to the eye. It is quiet. And it is, there's a serenity to it that you don't find in Tikal. And Copan compares very well with it. But this one is quietly beautiful. And the stucco figures are fluid in their design. You realize that many years went into the kind of skill that produced those stuccos. This is the path behind the Temple of the Inscriptions. And I went up this way and I went in a little ways. There's where you see unrestored mounds, just trees tearing them apart. But it goes quite a distance up into the mountains. This is that gallery that you can walk through. The Maya used what you call a corbel arch. They didn't know the true arch. to make an arch. Do you know what a corbel arch is? I don't want to insult you.
No.
Okay. What they do, they lay the stones farther and farther. They overlap them farther and farther until they get to the place where they can put a capstone on it. And somehow the stresses are right. I'm not an engineer and I don't know why it works, but it does, because that's the kind of arch that is used throughout the Maya world. You can see this gallery better. This is the East Gallery, and I was there. This is a morning photo. In the background, to the left, you're looking at the back part of the Temple of the Cross. That first one that's up on rather a high hill. We're inside the East Gallery, which is the gallery that has the most appeal, I think, to people, because it holds so much history, and it also has examples of the stonework that the people did and the stucco work that they did. You'll see various figures around there. Can you see them? They're little kind of upended rectangles. Those are all carved, and those represent rulers of Palenque. There are several of them that represent captive figures, people that have been taken for sacrifice. The Maya were not peace-loving people, necessarily. You can see remnants of the stucco up there on the roof. You can also see remnants of the roof comb that must have been up on top of that. What do you call that kind of a roof?
Mansard.
What?
Mansard.
Mansard roof, thank you. And here, these are just side by side in here. This is a cartouche. That's a little enclosed group of four glyphs there that represent the genealogy of this person over here, who is a ruler. Now you can see he's not a captive because he's not bound. He's wearing a headdress, so you know that he's a significant figure. More glyph panels in there. And also notice how the vegetation is still working, and it continues to work, and they pluck it out and it grows back. This, of course, is badly eroded, but you can see in the panel that at one time there was a headdress, see it up at the top? And this was a person, a representation of a person there. And all of these panels are decorated that way in stucco. And if you have a good imagination and you just sit down there and close your eyes for a minute, you can imagine what a magnificent place that courtyard was. Now this one is in a little bit better shape. Can you see his feet? Mm-hmm. Down at the bottom there? And the regalia that he's wearing? You wish you could do something to stop time there from doing its work. It's the humidity. And that's one reason that they have had such a hard time with residential segments, because in that climate, things that are perishable perish. This is a captive, a bound captive. And evidently this represents a lord who was taken captive. He wouldn't be in here if he weren't a lord. And he's to be sacrificed. These people we know are rulers because of what they're wearing. The captive had no headdress. He was a bound captive. But he's in this court because he was a royal lineage. Another figure of a ruler along with his genealogy. This stairway is a hieroglyphic stairway, And this tells the story of Lord Pikal and his son, and connects their existence to the gods, and it is their right to rule. There are some little features here I want you to be sure and see. Wherever you see these dots like this, they represent 1 year. And I'm trying to find one that has a bar in it, because the bar represents 5 years, the dot represents one, and I don't see them. This is a badly eroded stairway. But you have to keep in mind how old it is, 1,000 years old, and exposed to the weather, and the craftsmanship that produced that must have been something.
Are they trying to in some way preserve it with some preservatives, or do they just leave it?
I don't know. Now, in Copan, they're thinking of removing all the stela and taking them to the museum and just putting concrete replicas. And I just have reservations about that. I think that people who take the time and the energy to go there should see the real thing. But there is the other side of the coin, too. This will be gone eventually. You see, when it was covered with the jungle and with soil and with growth, it was somewhat protected. But now it's exposed to the elements. And you wonder, 1,000 years down the road, what will be left. Yeah. I think all they're doing, Ralph, is just trying to keep the jungle from eating it up. This is a path. You leave that gallery, and you're going up this path, and you're going to go over to the temple areas. But before we do, we're going to go to one of these little subterranean chambers, and that door doesn't open. But isn't that a strange configuration in the door? You peek in, and all you can see is darkness. And I've never been able to find out what on earth was ever in there. Notice on the right, can you see carving around the door? And they tell us that once that went all the way around and framed that door. Evidently, that chamber in there had some significance insofar as their religion was concerned. They think priestly rites were conducted in there. You come out from that area through this place that is almost tunnel-like. You can go past here and you can come out over here. And here is a bench. This is called Lord Pikal's bench because his name is on there. And I don't know whether he was the only one that got to sit there or, but that's what they call it. And if you came down these steps now, you would go across that little river and up to the three temples. This is Lord Pikal's bench. One of those is his sign, and I'm not sure which one it is. But again, you see the three little dots over there. Those are years. That particular glyph represents some element of time. That's just on the inside of that wall. That's a look into that kind of a subterranean corridor there. You can see a corner of the bench. Up on the wall, on one of the inside rooms, there's some original color. And so we know that many of these interior segments were painted. Red was a favorite color. And there was once a very complicated design that encircled that medallion type thing. Here also, there are just the remains of a scene there. But they're very proud of this, and this is pointed out to you that this represents some of the original color. Another example of their stucco. I don't know whether I told you, there are guards in this place. They're almost invisible. They're not wearing uniforms, but they are there. And so you're not going to pick up a piece of stucco and run off with it. Of course, you wouldn't, but some might. Now we're going up that little path toward the north group. You can see in the background the Temple of the Inscriptions. And do you see why I say it's very pleasing to the eye? It's almost park-like. And they have, those are planted trees there. And they're planted for shelter. There are little benches under some of them where you can sit down and take a breather. I have been there at various times of the day. My favorite time of the day is in the evening after most of the people are gone. This is the Temple of the Count. This is the place where the man came and did some work and messed up some things too, because he hadn't really researched what he ought to be doing. They think that there's a burial under there, but they have never gone down or tunneled in to find out. These are those little decrepit buildings in the north group, which are very old. They go back farther than 400, but not very far. They're interesting to me simply because of what they represent, I think. You can imagine that they were beautiful. Can you see little semblances of stairways there? That if they dug that all off, they're going to find remnants of probably a tiered approach to that building. That's just inside of one of the walls. And again, that series of glyphs represents the people who lived there and who built that place. See how the lichens are working on the rock over there? You can see the whole complex kind of spread out before you there now. Do you see the lower parts of the palace that haven't all been pulled out of the earth there? These are the unrestored ball courts. All of the Maya sites have ball courts, and the significance of the game differed from one place to another and from one situation to another. You're sure that sometimes it must have been played just for fun, but sometimes it was very serious business. And the loser, the captain of the losing team, became the sacrificial victim. There is a magazine here that you're welcome to borrow. In fact, I think it's right there. It says, A Solemn and Something Kind of Game. And it gives you an overview of how the game was played in the various Mesoamerican cities. Another ball court. There were two of them here, and they haven't dug into either one of them. But if they took earth off from there, they'd probably find something somewhat like we saw at Copan. You know, there'd be either perpendicular walls or there'd be a slanting wall. There are little pieces of things lying around, too, that you know belong to something, but what? In the background, you see another temple structure that has not been released from its mound. It's interesting to see those, because you know what it must have looked like before they cleared it away. Over on your right there, you're seeing a section of the Temple of the Cross, and you can see that it's built on an artificial terrace. The structure on the right is the Temple of the Sun that I told you that I sat down on, and on the little section in the front. And that little area has you feel like it's a place for meditation when you sit down there, particularly if you're there when there aren't too many people. And you're not seeing a lot of people, are you? See how the forest encroaches on the site. And the foliated cross, Temple of the Foliated Cross back there, they have to keep cutting the jungle back. There are people working there. There is a little river that runs through the site. Remember I showed you that? Sometimes they say it's quite full. And sometimes it's low. Right now, it is a little bit low. It's very cold, the water. It comes from the spring. Do you see the air plants growing on the side of that tree? They grow on wires. Everything grows. It just keeps growing and growing because of the humidity. This is an aqueduct, and it doesn't chill very well unless it's quite dark. But they had an aqueduct to carry water to the palace. In the palace, they had steam baths. And they got their water from that little stream, and it went through this aqueduct to the palace. Now, do you see these people down there with their feet in the water? Everybody does it because you're very hot. And this is quite a steep climb. You're going up to the Temple of the Cross, which has about four superimpositions, one thing built on top of another, or some kind of remodeling going on. And the roof cone, you have to imagine that it was once painted. So you make your way up there, but before you do that, you sit with your feet in the water a little while, and drop a little on your head, and then you're ready to go. She's drinking from the stream. I wasn't that brave. Now you can see that it looks as though it has been built onto, right? When you go inside, there's a stucco and carved panel that, again, is a monument to the ancestry of Shun, the Lam. And here it is. And there he is. And the story is told on either side. There's always a maze, representation of the maze god, too, someplace in here. And I don't think I got it. It's over to this side. I want you to see that there are two people in here. Can you see this one asking for something? From this one? Can you see that? Mm-hmm. Okay. Hard to take a photo in there because it's dark, and if you use the flash, it wipes it out. So those are things you need to see in a book. Can you see the pitch of that artificial terrace there? It's quite high. When you get back to the one that is in the background there's another panel that is carved with glyphs and also figures. And this is my sorriest photo, and I felt so sad about this because this is my favorite place. This is the Temple of the Sun, and it is a beautiful building. They have only released it from its earth mound on one side. They have left this one just as it was. But the stucco panels are just a marvel of construction. Well, I went back to the palace, and I decided I was going to climb that thing. And you had to go across a little narrow walkway like this. Do you remember that, Ralph?
Not particularly, no.
Yeah, just kind of a little thing, and I looked at it and I thought, I don't know. And then I thought, well, maybe you'll never be here again. So away I went.
I was a vagabond. I met a German fellow that had a little more than
I think I just did this about.
Had, I followed.
Probably about. The first time I was there was the time I climbed the tower, and I think that was probably about 1983. This place grows on you. In the forest, back of the Temple of the Inscriptions area, there is a group of people called the Lekandanis. And they still live. I'll bet some of you have read about them. Have you read about them?
I remember seeing these people. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they dress just like you're seeing here. They have maintained their culture. And they have done it with great difficulty, because they are the people of the mahogany forests. And the roads keep coming in, and the trees keep coming down. And these people are trying to hang on to their little piece of the world there. And what they're doing here is selling bows and arrows. And the person that you see over there to the right, with this person that I've traveled with a great deal in the Latin American countries, we buy Palenque.